Tonight on Arena, the most beautiful boy in the world, the Suicide Squad and the Sparks Brothers are the movies up for review. And we hear about Irish National Opera's new production of Richard Strauss's Elektra. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. We start as usual on Thursday nights with film reviews. The Suicide Squad is 2 hours and 12 minutes of a supervillain romp boasting an A-list cast that includes Idris Elba, Margot Robbie, Viola Davis, Sylvester Stallone and others. Curiously, a film also boasting all of the characters that featured in 2016's Suicide Squad. So what difference does the definite article make to the title of the film? We'll find out in our reviews this evening. The Most Beautiful Boy in the World from Danish directors Christina Lindstrom and Christian Petri is a documentary focusing on Bjorn Andresen, who as a 15-year-old boy starred in the movie Death in Venice. It's all about the experiences he had with the director Luchino Visconti. And those experiences still haunt him to this day. And we on the programme last night, if you were listening, we spoke with Ron and Russell Mayle, otherwise known as Sparks. Tonight we reviewed the documentary they were telling us about, The Sparks Brothers, directed by Edgar Wright. Michael Pope and Roe McDermott have watched all three. They're with me in studio this evening. Let's start with the Suicide Squad, if we could. Idris Elba, Margot Robbie, as I said, among the household names that we're hearing, that we have here. Written and directed by James Gunn, not to be confused with Simply Suicide Squad, which came out 5 years ago in 2016. So can you just set out the differences without getting me lost in a world of superheroes, Michael?
I have swearing, for one, and much more bloodshed. Basically, Suicide Squad was a PG-13 film from David Ayer, which kind of did okay money, but kind of bombed artistically. And this is kind of a reimagining of the actual kind of concept of Suicide Squad. So you've got Amanda Waller from the first film; she's there, and she's putting together the gang of dangerous supervillains once again. You've got Bloodsport, Idris Elba, a guy called Peacemaker, John Cena. You've got King Shark, played by Sylvester Stallone. Do I still have your attention?
Yes.
And others, and they're going on, they're going on a mission to this place called Quarter Maltese, which is in the middle of some political turmoil. And they're after a guy called The Thinker, played by Peter Capaldi, who's bald, bulbous, and has these kind of giant antenna poking out of his head. It's a search and destroy mission. It's a gang and mission. It's the Dirty Dozen. It's all that. Instead of the Suicide Squad, we have the very bloody and very profane Suicide Squad.
All right. Well, the hunt that they're on is for the supervillain called The Thinker, played by Peter Capaldi. And the human shark hybrid, that's King Shark, is played by Sylvester Stallone. And in this clip we're about to hear, King Shark fancies coming along with the rest of the squad and tries to persuade his teammates that a fake moustache is all the disguise that he needs.
The clothes in the box is for all of you, so you can blend in. That said, the walking tiburon is going to have to stay out of sight.
I wear disguise.
Oh, you're going to wear a disguise.
See?
Hey, he's learning Spanish.
And what kind of disguise?
Fake moustache.
Oh. Yeah, fake moustache isn't going to cut it, mate. You still look exactly like yourself.
Worst fake mustache I've ever seen.
And if you fooled us, we'd have to kill you. Shark-shaped bloke with a mustache creeping up on us like that.
Sylvester Stallone as King Shark in that clip from The Suicide Squad. Was the mustache dipping down over his mouth, or is that a fake accent he's putting on there for us as well?
No, at that point he was holding up his giant shark hand hybrid fins over his snout to illustrate what a moustache could look like on a human shark hybrid. So it was a very effective costume indeed. I think that was possibly one clip that your producer chose because it's one of the clips that doesn't have a huge amount of obscenities in it, because I think, as Michael noted, this film feels like a pushback against a lot of criticism against modern superhero films that centre on how PG and family friendly they've become, that they're often quite sexless, quite bloodless, and then there's endless franchising, which lowers the stakes hugely as no one ever really dies. But James Gunn, who wrote the Guardians of the Galaxy's Galaxy movies, who has been proven capable of writing really witty dialogue and great team dynamics and different characters, there is an element that he seems to believe that creating a superhero film for adults is an excuse to constantly use obscenity as a punchline the way a 12-year-old would. And look, I don't get me wrong, I swear like a sailor and I don't mind an obscenity or 75 in a film, but it becomes really lazy and really boring. And so I just think it's hilarious that that's one of the only clips that was deemed suitable to be displayed on RTE.
It's 35 seconds long, and the film itself is 132 minutes long, which may also tell us something, mm-hmm. Michael. Just talk to me a little bit. I mean, obviously, when we get to an action movie like this and the superhero and all of that stuff involved, you want a bit of action. You want a bit of laugh as well. You want that balance between action and humour. Do they strike that? Is that got here?
Not as much as James Gunn did in his Guardians of the Galaxy brace, I will say. I mean, there's so much action. People are exploded, ripped apart, impaled, sluiced by flying polka dots. The less I say about that the better. And plain old eaten alive by that shark. But it's long and it's loud and it just keeps on going. And just when you think you've reached the end of it and there's been enough explosions and enough collapsing buildings, then you have a giant space starfish and mini starfish and smashing and shooting. And it kind of, suppose it depends on your appetite for this kind of thing. And mine is definitely cuts off around an hour 40. And here we have, as you said, I think it'll be 2:30, 2:32.
Yeah, 2 hours 12.
I'm desensitized. I'm completely exhausted by that stage. Yeah. So, you know, I've had my fill of everything by then. I mean, he's having a lot of fun. James Gunn came from a production house known as Troma, which was very, very low budget, kind of idiosyncratic, farcical, violent horror films with minuscule budgets. So this is like his Troma movie with 150 times the budget. And I can't blame him for going for it.
I never have a problem with somebody having a lot of fun, as long as the viewer is allowed to have a lot of fun as well and it's not a bundle of in-jokes. Was it that for you, first of all, Ro, but also I think you wanted to specifically mention the Margot Robbie character?
Yeah, so I think there's an issue for me in that I think a lot of films go against the kind of family-friendly grain and do it effectively. So Deadpool would be kind of the notable R-rated exception that has so much sarcasm and sex and extreme violence. But Deadpool works because it's funny consistently and the humour ranges because it has Ryan Reynolds' sardonic one-liners, it has sexual innuendo, it has absurdism, it has pop culture references, it has meta commentary on the superhero genre, it has visual gags and extreme violence that's designed to shock. So if one type of joke doesn't land for you, another one is going to come flying in fast. And this is the issue with Suicide Squad. It's repetitive. The jokes are extremely repetitive and the characters aren't developed well enough to be funny in their own right. I think Margot Robbie is completely the star of this. She reprises her role as Harley from, I guess, Suicide Squad, the ex-boyfriend we no longer speak about, is kind of the trend of this film that you're not allowed to mention the predecessor. And she's amazing and she's gamely mischievous and she's punky and she has just this amazing wide smile, a way of brandishing a machine gun while wearing a ball dress that is just gloriously good fun to watch. And she gets the best action sequence of the film because Harley's talent for kind of tricking captors and then defeating them with a mix of gymnastics, punches, cartoonish visuals and great props is just irresistible. But Harley Quinn gets no further characterization from Gunn's script, and all of the other characters have one specific character trait that he just plays on again and again. Right. We have Bloodsport, Idris Elba is a bit angsty, Polka Dot Man has mother issues, and he just repeats these punchlines. And it just gets really, really boring. And then I think the other problem is Gunn seems to believe that adult superhero movies need to be as nihilistic as possible to combat the threat of this PG tone. But he overcorrects and then he hits against the same problem as the family-friendly fare. If no one ever dies, there are no stakes. But if everyone can die at every moment and frequently too, we don't care because there are no stakes either. So now, it falls really, really flat for me.
James Gunn, you mentioned there about Deadpool. He banked $1 billion for DC with that film. Do you think we're in a big hit here, even though I think both your critical noses seem to be rather upturned on this one, Michael?
Well, I was very happy to enjoy this film last night with a crowd, small crowd albeit, but not one single joke in the 132 minutes landed for the crowd.
You were watching it
in an actual cinema, and it is kind of Gunn's type of edgy, witty banter. 2.5 hours of it. I mean, I think in terms of fluff, in terms of kind of a fast food entertainment, I mean, Harley Quinn, Rose is correct. She is the best thing in the movie. Her section is the most fun. And I mean, I think it will be fairly forgotten in a while. It's pretty average.
Stars?
2.5.
2.5 from Michael. Ro, what are you saying for stars out of 5?
Yeah, 2.5 for me. I just think it's really disappointing that the idea that films for grown-ups need to be nastier, less funny and more emotionally immature than ones for kids. That seems like a move in the wrong direction. 2.5 from me.
Fair enough. Let's move on then to the Most Beautiful Boy in the World documentary exploring the life of Swedish actor Björn Andresson, who rose to fame as a 15-year-old boy in the movie Death in Venice, but suffered all sorts of anguish and trauma in later years, possibly as a result of his dealings with Lucina Visconti, although this film may say may tell us other things as well. First of all, this film, it revolves around Björn Andresson. To what extent is it about Death in Venice and his experiences there, or does it broaden out into other areas very quickly?
I think something I found interesting and frustrating about the film is that the film addresses the life of Björn Andresson after this film Death in Venice, which came out in 1971, and it looks at the kind of cultural response to this 15-year-old who was held up as the most beautiful boy in the world, and how culture responded to him and his career immediately after that and his life immediately after that. And then it goes into other events in his life and how they were also traumatizing in a way, but the filmmakers seem to circle back constantly to this era in his life, a kind of formative and informing his kind of sad existence now as we meet him. You know, we meet him and he seems to be depressed. He's living in this really filthy flat. He's under a threat of eviction. He's really struggling. He's having fights with his much younger girlfriend. And the filmmakers seem to want us to draw a line directly from Death in Venice to this situation, even though the film does present evidence of multiple contributing factors. So I think it's an interesting examination of someone's life that possibly creates a too simplistic causal correlation.
Yeah, there was that aspect to it, I felt, Michael, that we get the obviously the young boy in Death in Venice, and he was such a beautiful young boy. It was Visconti who uttered the phrase "the most beautiful boy in the world" regarding Andresson as a teenager. Are they stretching the point too much to try to say everything that happened to this man has to do with Death in Venice? Because he had I don't want you to give anything away in terms of his family background, but he had a difficult family background.
He did. He had a lot of trauma in his life at a very young age. I think the film keeps going back to Death in Venice and the experience of meeting Lucio Visconti, and who was travelling Europe at the time, and he was admiring, to be frank, semi-naked young boys, and he would command them to undress on camera. Now, Visconti would claim this was non-sexual. It was Bjorn's beauty, but also his frailty and his stillness and his loneliness that kind of captured him. But we keep going back to this moment of him on set in 1971. But I think that's because Bjorn can't help but go back there either. He seems this as the kind of the fulcrum of which his life turned. Even though he'd had trauma before that, I think it's important that we keep going back to that, because he's always looking inwards. He's an unwilling tourist in his own past, and he finds it very difficult to let go of any of that past. So I think the filmmakers kind of know that, and it's not. I don't think it's shortchanging the film to say that we go back there a lot, because he's always back there.
Yeah. How does Visconti? We do see Visconti in archive material. How is he portrayed, or how does he come across in the material that were shown in the film role?
Yeah, I will say again, I found the film so interesting on a subject letter and kind of subject level, and frustrating on an execution level, because Visconti was openly gay during the 1970s, which was a stigmatized position. He employed a mostly gay crew, which was kind of important and notable. And he employed a mostly gay crew on the set of Death in Venice. But the film makes sure to explicitly states that he made sure nobody ever went near Andresson. But then this filmmaker seemed to want us to nudge us in that direction. There's no doubt that Andresson felt very objectified by the attention he received afterwards. He was kind of thrust into the limelight as this beautiful and sexualized being when he was 15, which would undoubtedly be really traumatic for any teenager. But the film inadvertently kind of adopts this undercurrent of homophobia. Andresson, it's never, ever explicitly stated that he was sexually assaulted in any way, but it points at this. It says, oh, he was, you know, he was brought to a gay nightclub and it was a very sexualized environment. But being a child in an adult space doesn't necessarily mean that gay men who are in a nightclub were inherently being predatory towards a child. And those correlations become very uncomfortable for me. And I think, again, the film states Visconti said, no, I want to protect this boy. And then, you know, didn't make sure in the years afterwards that he was protected.
Yeah,
but
it's
again,
all right.
There's a very big difference between someone being negligent and someone being predatory.
Yeah, and there's a big difference too.
Doesn't make that very clear, yeah, I think.
Obviously, he could look after him on the set. And there was some kind of contractual, we're not given all the contractual details, but
no,
there was ownership
not.
Over the image of Andresen for 3 or 4 years after the film. I hope he got paid for that. We don't get the detail on that. But do we get any hint as to where his career went after Michael?
Well, most recently, I didn't realise this, that he was in Midsommar.
Yeah.
Quite a pivotal role in Midsommar. Small, but pivotal. After Death in Venice, there's kind of the most interesting section of the film is when he is kind of describing they can only be described as Beatlemania scenes when he ends up in Japan as a 16-year-old. He ends up there as a 65-year-old man as well. He was kind of known as, quote-unquote, the first idol from the West. He ended up recording jingles for chocolate bars and became an inspiration to this whole generation of manga artists. He was...
I wonder, did he get paid for the use of his image there? Or who got paid, if anybody, for the use of his image?
Well, if he was, it certainly doesn't translate into a 65. It's kind of hard. It never really touches on the financial aspect of it. Yeah. More of how uncomfortable and he was with being thrust into such a maelstrom of activity as a 16-year-old boy. They had a term from over there, Bishonen, which means a Japanese term, literally meaning a young man of androgynous beauty. So he was and probably still remains an icon over there. But I don't think the 65-year-old man, as Ro said, living, he's now a sunken husk of grief and doubt, living and looking like an aging prog rock wizard.
And to what extent then, Ro, did you find yourself frustrated at the film you wanted to see and being frustrated by the film that you were seeing? Were they very far apart from each other, those two, what you wanted and what you got?
I think as a character study, it could have been just really, you know, moving and poignant, because as Michael said, it is a kind of a portrait of trauma and a traumatised person revisiting this era and kind of imagining what would my life have been like if I wasn't the most beautiful boy in the world, and would have this been such? And I think a portrait of trauma is an inherently very worthy project and something I would have been comfortable watching and would have thought was worthy. But the film, even the way it's edited and that there's a very oppressive score that kind of constantly creates a sinister atmosphere, when again the filmmakers are alluding to things but never making things explicit. So I felt like I was being manipulated to think that there were certain traumatic events that were never confirmed, and I had problems with that. But I think the other option could have been to look at kind of the broader issue of children being objectified and thrown into this culture where they are sexualized in a way. And I think right now, particularly when we're re-examining the exploitation of vulnerable young stars such as Britney Spears, for example, this would have felt like a really interesting chapter of that discussion. But the film remains kind of intimately focused without being intimately insightful, which I think was my problem.
Stars then from you, Ro, on it.
I'm going to give it 3. I think there is a really important discussion to be had here. I think Andresen's career and that chapter is really important. I kind of felt uncomfortable because I felt like this is a man who's clearly still haunted by demons and traumas. He's not ready to fully articulate yet, and maybe he should have been left to process them privately with lots of support instead of being on screen yet again in a way that I'm not sure was completely successful. So 3 from me.
And what would you say overall in stars, Michael?
I'll go 4 out of 5. I found it really interesting. Although all of Ro's points certainly are valid, certainly I did enjoy it as a kind of a character study and of the difference between what can happen in 50 years of a man's life.
Okay, 3 and 4 respectively then from Ro and Michael for The Most Beautiful Boy in the World. And let's finish up with the Sparks Brothers documentary homage from director Edgar Wright. Appearances from Jonathan Ross, Mike Myers, Bjork, Tony Visconti. The list just goes on and on. Ro, how would you describe this cult of Sparks, if I can call it that? Very unlike any other cult cultural cult anyway that I've read about. It seems to renew itself just on a regular basis.
Yeah, so this is the very eccentric musical entity invented and fronted by Ron and Russell Mayall. And they're sometimes rock, sometimes pop, sometimes art song, always idiosyncratic. They're a cult band with this ever-renewing cult and career that spans 50 years. And their image has always been one of idiosyncrasy and contrast. So they came out in the 1970s, and the lead singer Russell was, you know, slim, bouncy haired, beautifully faced, and it made him kind of prime rock star material. You know, he could have been a rock legend, he could have been a rock god, he would have been absolute heartthrob material. But then right beside him, hunched over a keyboard, was Ron, who was the songwriting brother, who was spindly and pale, and he had fashioned a moustache that has been described as uncomfortably poised between Charlie Chaplin and Hitler. And then what comes out of their mouths and out of their keyboards is this constantly changing style, but often embraces this arch falsetto that is sometimes uncomfortable to listen to. They're singing ditties about Albert Einstein and breast milk, not in the same song, though they absolutely could have. And their weird guitar riffs and baroque song structures that are insane and ever changing. And so Sparks Brothers are a cult who inspired this renewing cult, and they're just impossible to describe. And Edgar Wright leans into explaining their appeal by emphasizing how it can't really be explained.
Yeah, which is fair enough. I have to say, I spoke to the two brothers on the program last night. They're absolute gentlemen. In fact, you know, in some ways, I expected, oh, this is going to be really difficult. They won't answer a single question. They answered dead straight. They weren't shirking away off anything. And they were very clear. Look, we weren't just this town ain't big enough for the both of us. We weren't just a Giorgio Moroder band at one point along the way. And they went through several of their incarnations and said, we have changed all along, and this documentary shows all of that. And it's a lot. It's five
They're
decades.
They're shedding a lot of skin every couple of years, 25 albums at last count. I mean, they are more gregarious and friendly than I expected. It doesn't mean I get to really know them very well. I get to know their body of work exquisitely. I mean, Edgar Wright, like, I didn't know, I've never been a Sparks fan. And after 2.5 hours, I'm still not a Sparks fan, but I know a lot about Sparks. I didn't know they started out as that California jam hippie surf band. And Edgar Wright just seems content rather than getting to know them, because they do remain frustratingly out of reach. There's not really much to say. And especially when you're looking for an anecdote, they kind of say stuff happened on the road, but we'll never mention it. So what you get is just a ream of everything. It's stop motion, stock footage, animation, claymation, talking heads with all the celebrities you mentioned and more, voiceover, even some kind of faux recreations of Russell and Ron going surfing, complete with fake film scratches and stuff. There's really so much information and footage and in here that it's really, really entertaining, but it doesn't really, it's still very surface level, which I've always found their music to be.
Yeah, so it is
arch and it is absurd and it is abstract, but it is detached as well.
Well, let's have a listen to a clip from the documentary, because they're talking about this idea of whether it's, you know, this is just a band that are surface and humour, and the humour is taken out. It's a kind of a novelty act, if you like. And you'll hear amongst this clip arguing the point about humour in music. Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Weird Al Yankovic, Tony Visconti, the producer, and the brothers themselves.
Something that's always kind of confounded me in popular music is people's inability to take humor seriously. And I think that's one of the things, like, why a band like Sparks isn't as big as the biggest bands in the world. Because they're fucking funny.
You had sense, you had style, you had cash galore.
A lot of critics and some fans sometimes denigrate bands that show their sense of humor. Like, oh, it's a comedy band, it's a joke band. I just don't get that. I don't know why it has to be so stinking serious.
I thought it was going to be a smash hit album because it was so different. And anyone could see that we spent hours of work and put detail in it. And the songs were so great. And Russell's singing was amazing. The world just didn't agree with us, you know. It did well, but not that well.
We were so irate, just lack of acceptance for what we thought was an amazing album, that we were seriously considering recording Louie Louie as our next single, you know, just for spite.
The Sparks Brothers there, and where humour fits into their work, if you like. Tony Visconti was the producer that we heard in the middle of all of that as well. Ro, do you go along with what Michael said, that this is a very surface act, or do we in fact get underneath the skin of the two artists? They're never going to tell us about their private life. That's just off limits. But do we get under the skin of the artist?
No, I don't think we do. I think we get under the spirit of them. And I think Edgar Wright does something really clever in terms of evoking the sense of fun and their artistry and their quirkiness, because the film employs stop motion and 2D animation, has reenactment videos, has props and moving cameras during talking head videos. And I think Wright knows that a lot of people won't be familiar with the 25 years of Sparks Brothers discography. But he knows that they want to have fun, and he knows he wants the documentary to feel alive and quirky and fun, and artistically it's quite fun to watch. But yeah, we don't hear a thing. We have a brief mention of one relationship and nothing else about any other relationships. And something I was instantly fascinated by, because they immediately hone in on Ron and this mustache he has that's constantly compared to Hitler. They don't address the fact that the Mayall brothers are Jewish. They're born years after, just simply a few years after the Holocaust, to parents called Meyer and Miriam, and they've steadily devoted their lives to being outsider artists. And yet for years Ron was described as that Hitler guy. And even that, as an artistic choice, feels important to reference, and they don't go anywhere near it.
Although,
and I think it's exactly what Michael said. Oh, sorry.
Exactly what Michael said. What did you want to agree with?
Oh, that, I think a lot of people, a barrier to connecting with Sparks music is that, yes, it's fun and it's lively, but it needs an emotional connection. And here, I wanted a bit of emotional connection.
And what does that mean in stars from you, Ro?
I'm going to say it's a 4. I think as a music documentary, it's really good fun. It is 20 minutes too long, easily. Could have gone, it gets a little bit repetitive. But as a documentary about the brothers themselves, no, I think it should have been the Sparks career rather than the Sparks brothers.
Although I did like, I have to say, Michael, as I ask you for your final comments, the way the brothers were, clearly they hugely respect each other. The film's dedicated to their parents, and that is a very big statement from men who say nothing about their private lives.
They do. That's one of the only things we get to know. We get to know about their relationship with their father, who passed away when they were young. As one review from a punk magazine read, introducing Sparks, unfortunately, we've already met. Well, I never met Sparks until now, and I still don't really know who Ron and Russell are, but I can't really deny enjoying such a trip through their pop culture archive. It's great fun. 3.5 out of 5 for me.
3.5 out of 5 from Michael, and that's Michael Pope and Ro McDermott speaking about our 3 films this evening: The Sparks Brothers, The Suicide Squad, and The Most Beautiful Boy in the World. 27 minutes to 8 o'clock on Thursday night's Arena. One of my next guests spent the first lockdown listening to the entire musical output of the German composer Richard Strauss. At least that's what he told me. That's what Fergus Shield told me when he was in here around that time. But he has put all that listening to good use, as he's programmed his company Irish National Opera show for this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival to be Elektra, the opera by Richard Strauss, a story of bloodlust and revenge. Daughter Elektra seeking revenge on her mother, Clytemnestra, who has killed her father, Agamemnon. The opera will be set in the courtyard of Kilkenny Castle. Elektra, sung and played by Giselle Allen, and the production will be directed by Conal Morrison, who is joining me this evening, along with Fergus Shield. So, Fergus, I think even when we spoke about that lockdown activity of yours, walking around listening to the entire output, starting at the very beginning, at Opus 1, and you worked your way through it, I think even at that time, Elektra, and before your lockdown listening, Elektra was an opera you wanted to do.
Hello, Sean. Yes, I do remember that. And it's true. I did listen to the entire output of Strauss, and I adore his music for lots of reasons. It's very passionate, very beautiful, exquisite. And probably, I was already beginning to think of which of his operas we could program with Irish National Opera. Is not a composer that is hugely featured in operatic life in Ireland, because a lot of his pieces, like Wagner and others, they're large in scale, they're very ambitious, they demand the type of voices that really are rare to come by, and they need huge orchestral forces and a massive canvas onto which to do them. So I have yet, I had yet to plan any of his operas or any of Wagner's operas, even though they're all like ambitions of mine. And now we've taken the plunge, and we're starting with Elektra.
Yeah, and Elektra, as you say, hugely dramatic in terms of music and the forces that are involved. But from a pure drama point of view, or from the dramatist's point of view, Conal Morrison, where does Elektra sit?
Well, it's based on the Sophocles play, and Hugo von Hofmannsthal, the librettist, had written a play of it, and Strauss saw it and asked him to collaborate on an opera with him. So Hofmannsthal was very keen, pushed ahead. Strauss spent 2 years working on it, He found it difficult because it seemed to connect into some of his own stories. His father had died, and his father had been very hard on him. And then his mother had a kind of breakdown and spent the rest of her life in a sanatorium. So a lot of the themes that are actually in the Elektra story, in terms of turmoil and dreams and difficulty with the parents and all sorts of conflicts, it went into the writing of it. So it took Strauss a long time to fulfill it. But it shows in the mastery. It's so complete. It's so satisfyingly complex, and it's so dramatically rich. It's absolutely underpinned by a kind of a searing authenticity, and that makes it an absolutely thrilling piece to work on, and it'll be a thrilling piece for people to see it.
Let's have a listen to some of the music just to get a sense of the size and the sheer the drama that's involved, even in the little section that we're about to use to listen to, Fergus. This is from an orchestral piece from near the end of the opera. Just to give us a sense of what we should be listening out for in this particular section.
Well, just also to say, Sean, that for this production, we're taking an unusual approach, again, inspired by unusual circumstances in 2021. And we're going to be performing with a pre-recorded orchestra. So a few weeks ago, and myself and 79 of the best musicians in Ireland went into the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre and recorded what will essentially be the soundtrack for our performances. And that's what you're going to play a little bit now. So what people will hear will be the same as in the performance. It comes towards the very end of the opera. Elektra says all along that when this deed is committed, the revenge of her father's death, that she will dance on the graves of her mother and her mother's partner, Aegist. And this is the dance, just as everything has been completed. And it's really the culmination of everything in the opera, filled with all sorts of motifs and ideas that we've heard all through the evening. And it's a glorious piece of orchestral music, which comes just near the end.
A little section there from the orchestral music from towards the end of Richard Strauss's Elektra, and that in the recording that will actually be used, the orchestral recording that will be used as an accompaniment to the singers in Irish National Opera's production of Elektra, which is happening at this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. Conall Morrison, I know you like to have music in your productions, Conall, in regular theatre, as it were. But boy, when you have the music of Richard Strauss as dramatic as that for a dance on a grave, you're given a lot to go with.
Oh, I mean, you really are. I mean, they say that all art aspires to the condition of music, you know, and my God, this one delivers on it. The score is just phenomenal, and it's so dramatically astute as well. I mean, musically, it's just entrancing and enlivening, and just knocks you off your seat. But actually, the way himself, it's the combination of Hoffmann-style dramatic skills and Strauss's musical genius, that actually everything is constantly furthering the story, all of the motifs that Fergus was talking about. Everything, while it's both musically thrilling in itself, it's all furthering the story, it's all deepening the plot, it's all going deep down into the dark emotions. So at the end, we've been doing run-throughs this week, and, you know, obviously it's my job to give notes afterwards, but it almost feels kind of impertinent to give notes, because you just finish the run-through and you just go, wow, you know, because these actors just seize on it. They give it everything. The combination of their commitment, their talent, and this score, you're just left going, whoa, you know, whatever, what do I have to say after that, you know? And that's what great... you know, great performance should ideally be.
And given that it is the title role here, Elektra, is she given the lion's share of the work to do in this opera? Because I can imagine how exhausting performing a Richard Strauss piece must be vocally. Giselle Allen is the singer here, Fergus.
Yeah, I think this must be one of the most difficult of all soprano roles. And I mean, it's certainly the most taxing role I've done. It's not the longest opera. It's only an hour and 45 45 minutes. It's performed with no interval, but she's on stage throughout, and she really has music of very, very high intensity. Whether that's it's emotional, it's longing, it's full of love for her brother, for her family, but it's also violent and there's outbursts. So it's full octane, high octane all the way, and I was so delighted that Giselle would do this. Giselle's a fantastic singer from Belfast too. We haven't yet featured at Irish National Opera, although I've wanted to for some time. And when I put this idea to her only a few months ago that we began planning it, she said yes, and I was so excited that she would do it because she has just the right voice. It's full, it's dramatic, it's powerful, but she can also be extremely lyrical, beautiful. She has a top range right up to the high notes, and yet has a power right throughout the range. So she's a fantastic actor as well. When she performs, she gives it really 100%. So it's a thrilling ride, as Connell says, and I think audiences who see it are going to be in for a treat.
What about that balance, Connell, between the drama and the characterisation that we need for this to be believable, albeit that we're in obviously the very heightened world of Greek tragedy? We need it to be believable on a purely human scale. The balance between that and the largeness, the hugeness of the music that is there to accompany that.
Yeah, we do indeed. I mean, these kind of Greek tragedies are so intense that it really demands that the performers all go to quite a remarkable kind of height of intensity just to earn the right to tell that story, you know. And if you don't, the whole thing could just seem melodramatic, or at worst could seem kind of ridiculous. But that's, I mean, Strauss is doing a lot of the work for you by the kind of the dark magnificence of the score. But it would be nothing if the performers couldn't do it. And these singers are absolutely committed to it. You know, they've seized this opportunity. Everybody's coming out of lockdown. Everybody kind of cleared away the rust from the undercarriage, and they've absolutely launched themselves with this material. So they convince, you know, by their commitment
and I guess
to the material.
Yeah, I would just
as Fergus was saying, just, you know, Giselle is as good an actor as she is a singer, and by God, she's a hell of a singer. So it's a remarkable performance from Giselle at the centre of this piece.
And I guess from your point of view, Fergus, just to put the question the other way around, how important was it to have somebody like Connell coming, I suppose, from a more, although I don't know if I could call Connell's productions particularly traditional theatre productions, but, you know, coming from a theatre background, to have that characterization and that sensibility behind the production as well?
Well, absolutely. And I know I figured that the subject matter would be of interest to Connell, but we also needed somebody who would be imaginative in that we're playing outdoors. It's going to be performed in a courtyard. We have to embrace, all of us, Connell, myself, all the cast, we have to embrace the unknown. We've not done something like this before. Things like even lighting and video, there's going to be a lot of video in the production as well. There's so many elements, amplification of the orchestra, singers. So there's we needed a director who would have the big picture, give us the details, but also be somebody who would, you know, be happy to embrace the unknown. And that's what we're doing in the next few days.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, Connell. In fact, I think you're on the move tomorrow, isn't it? And the outdoor aspect of this, what kind of challenges does that present?
To be honest, the only challenge is the weather, in case it drowns us out. But apart from that, everything just feeds in to this piece. The Electra set, it says, in the inner court of the Palace of Mycenae. So in the castle yard there, it feels as if it's actually purpose-built for this opera, with the clock tower and the big door that registers as a kind of as the palace. And then the lovely circular wall is the courtyard, and that's the courtyard that Electra haunts. She lives outside in the wild like a feral animal. So it's actually ideal for this piece. And because there's so much reference to, there's the gods and the elements and all of the forces, you know, we'll be connecting up to the sky and to the whatever wind is playing and so on. So the setting down there in Kilkenny is not just kind of beautiful in itself, but it's absolutely perfect for this For this piece, so everybody's very excited about going down there. You know, it'll only kind of it'll house the piece perfectly.
But you are giving it. I don't know if modern is quite. I suppose it is a modern twist, or certainly a 20th century twist in terms of where you're locating it in time.
I'm just updating it a wee bit. It's, you know, it's set in, or it was premiered in 1909. You know, written 2 years before that, but. And obviously, the horrors of the First World War were just around the corner. But what I hear in it, in terms of the some of the savagery and the darkness and the violence that's in it, it feels as if it's kind of horribly prophetic of what happened in the Second World War. You know, just some of the intensities and the hatreds and the self-perpetuating cycles of violence. It feels as if it kind of it lands in 1944. And I know that, you know, I don't want to put people off, but a lot of the, you know, the Nazis loved this piece. They were thrilled by it, you know, Goering in particular. And, you know, which and I think that there's something in it that just, you know, that its depiction of darkness obviously appealed to them, you know. Now, that's just important to say that the piece also has kind of love and redemption and all sorts of other colours in it. But I just think it's striking that it spoke to that political climate. It spoke to that darkness.
Yeah, what would that side of Strauss for you, Fergus, is the Nazism that others may read into it, is it problematic?
Well, of course, I mean, this was, as Conal said, it was 1909, so it was long before Nazism was thought about. But Strauss did live on through the Nazi era, and although he was quite an elderly man at that stage, there were suggestions that, you know, he wasn't maybe as clean as some people would like him to have been. But I think this piece is like it's one of his earlier operas. It's an explosion of energy and ideas. It's like there's so many ideas in the piece that it's hard to keep up with his thought process in a way. And I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed about it is delving into the score and finding more and more notes. Like everything is connected and everything is done purposefully. Like there's an incredible architecture in the score.
Yeah.
That there's almost like a note that isn't out of place. He has thought about every single thing, and it's a real lesson also in orchestration, how he puts together this orchestral score and the details. And we had this vast orchestra of, as I said, 79 musicians spread out over, you know, everybody 2 meters apart from each other. The actual physical space that it took up was absolutely enormous. Yeah. And there's a lot to enjoy in it, I think.
All right. Well, listen, great to have spoken to the both of you this evening. That's Conal Morrison, director, and Fergus Shield, artistic director of Irish National Opera. And that upcoming production of Electra is at the Kilkenny Arts Festival from the 5th through to the 14th of August of next month. And you can find out full details on ino.ie and on the Kilkenny Arts Festival website as well. Earlier this evening, a new exhibition, Queer Mind, Body and Soul, opened at the National Gallery of Ireland. 16 artists working in animation, painting, sculpture and more explore a range of experiences familiar to many LGBTQIA+ and gender non-conforming young people today. The show is a collaboration between the National Gallery's Apollo Project and the Gashka Like-Minded Group, both initiatives aimed at those 25 and under. Gashka, self-development programme whose patron has been the Irish president since the days of Patrick Hillary, and Like-Minded is a specific group for LGBT people. I'm delighted to say that Ger Brady, project lead with Gashka, and Sarah Hannigan, spoken word artists, join me now. Sarah, let's start with the art, if we can, and your piece, Self-Sovereignty, to start us off. Will you introduce this to us as we listen, Sarah?
My piece is called Self-Sovereignty. It's in two parts. One is a wire torso. It's a sculpture. And accompanying it, I have a piece of poetry as well.
So let's hear the poem then.
Self-Sovereignty. It became a weapon, a reason to love or hate me, to use, distrust, or leave behind. When I said I am bi, I meant I am free, light, and divine. Not a toy for him and her, not twice the slut from before, not unholy, confused goods. slowly, slowly, I built my armor. I burnt my heart out and pricked anyone close. My body was barely mine before it was claimed, marked, and labeled. I was thawed inside and out. How to? Prove it. Present it. Share it. Sell it. Talk about it. Tell the folks about it. I'm still learning how to love her. On knowing we are more than the sums of our parts. On seeing my light. On telling my folks. On disabling weapons.
And that's Sarah Hannigan with her poem Self-Sovereignty, which is part of her artwork that is in the exhibition Queer Mind, Body and Soul, which opened at the National Gallery of Ireland earlier this evening. Just stay with you for the moment, Sarah. Very struck by that line, slowly I built my armour. At what point did you feel that you could begin to let down that armour and open out, if you like? And how has this exhibition helped you express that letting down or dismantling of your armour?
Yeah, so I think a lot of young people growing up, it's very difficult to be vulnerable with other people because we experience a lot of things like homophobia and assumptions that are made about us before we even are, you know, allowed to speak our truth. For me, I was able to kind of explore my identity through things like like-minded, through my art. And honestly, I went to counseling for a while to help me get in touch with myself and kind of learn to accept myself before I could let other people in, before I could put down that armor. But right. This project for like-minded has really helped me delve into that and kind of re-experience those things again and process them a little bit more.
And the extraordinary bravery, if I can say so to you without being in any way patronising, incredibly brave to actually do that. It can't be an easy thing to do. And I guess sitting in front of me, Ger Brady, that's what we're getting in this exhibition, not just Sarah, but 15 others working in all of the various art forms that I mentioned, bravely stating, here I am, this is me.
They're extraordinary young people. I mean, it's been an absolute privilege to work with them, to watch them develop, to come into their voices. They're questioning the world and they're challenging. You heard Sarah here first. I'll just say that now. There, it's just I would recommend that everybody that gets the opportunity would go into the gallery. It's on for 11 weeks and 2 days, and to go in and see those pieces, to see what those young people have to say. Participants.
I guess it's energy that that's what I'm expecting to feel, because I got it off that poem from Sarah, and even as she was describing the sculpture that runs alongside it. I'm guessing energy is the big thing that's in there at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. And the diversity of the pieces. I mean, they've worked with, there's embroidery, there's spoken word, there's dance. It's a real mix. And it was them to kind of work through and use the artistic expression to kind of work through their gender identity and sexual orientation with the help of Shireen, who is a creative facilitator, and the National Gallery, who's Kate, who was just, I mean, the gallery have been amazing, and they launched it today, this evening. It was the minister launched it. It's a very powerful
Was it a virtual launch?
It's a virtual, unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, we have, and when you talk about virtual, I mean, these young people we met over Zoom every week. I said, how is this going to happen? Zoom is where creativity goes to die. But they were there every single week, pulling, you know, before we would have worked collaboratively and everybody would have been looking at each other's pieces. But we came every week. The energy from these young people is just, it really is a privilege.
Yeah, because I would love to be asking you, Sarah, about what was it like seeing your work in the National Gallery in situ, and that you could walk around it and see the others' work as well. But from what Ger is saying there, it seems as if, despite the fact that, for obvious reasons, we're involved in virtual acts a lot in recent times, that there was a great, did you have a great sense of community around what you were doing?
Yeah, no, we actually this morning got to go in and view all the artworks themselves. We were able to bring some friends and family along, just a private viewing. So that was absolutely incredible to be able to see our own artwork in such a prestigious place as the National Gallery. It was really emotional. So much energy. Like, you could feel it walking into the room.
And I guess for a community, and you are part of a community that is quite often marginalised, to be right there at one of the central cultural bodies in the state, that must have been vitally important, must have felt very important thing to you.
It's incredible. We've had so many conversations about just how much it means to us to see the LGBT community in Ireland not only accepted but also celebrated on such like a righteous stage.
Yeah, exactly, because it is such an important spot, Ger, and to think that you have such a pillar, you know, a mainstream aspect of culture supporting marginalised communities, that's vitally important.
Oh, absolutely, and it's the first LGBTI exhibition held in the gallery, and as one of the young people said this morning, it was like, here we are, up against, next to Rembrandt. I mean, it is just...
Yeah, I'm looking to in front of me here at Acceptance by Bevan Collins, series of four portraits of the same person. Maybe would you talk me through this a little bit?
Yeah, no, it's a series of four paintings and it explores, I suppose, homophobia, internalised homophobia. And as the paintings progress, it is coming about is about accepting oneself and becoming part of a community. The work as well was for allies as well, for young people, and the role of an ally is hugely important.
Explain what you mean for allies.
So allies are people that support, so people from the heterosexual community who support young people, who support anybody from the LGBTQI community. And we're saying, you know, there's no need for medals or awards for people who are allies. It is actually just being a genuine human being to accepting everybody for their diversity, for their differences.
And Sarah, predominantly you're a spoken word artist, which is why I wanted to hear your poem so quickly at the top of the item. But what about that, the aspect of the exhibition here moving towards sculpture? What did that bring in terms of expression to you that maybe isn't there in the spoken word side of things?
I really wanted just something visual and obviously not tactile with COVID, but something that people could instantly relate to when they walked into a space. Often people who aren't into poetry just aren't into poetry and they're not going to read it and try and think about it at all. So I wanted something that was very eye-catching that people could feel more emotionally connected to and try and understand experiences through a different medium.
And having explored sculpture briefly then, do you think it's a medium that you might continue to work?
I mean, it was so fun. I used like a lot of chicken wire and I got so many scratches, but it was the most fun I've had with a piece of art, I swear.
Right. Well, listen, congratulations on it all and continued success. And thanks for joining us this evening. That's Sarah Hannigan joining us on the line and with me in studio here, Ger Brady. And Queer Mind and Soul is at the National Gallery of Ireland until the 17th of October. The exhibition is free, but advance booking is required. So make sure to check out the website, which is nationalgallery.ie. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock once again here on RTE Radio 1.